conditions de félicité qui sont très difficiles à obtenir. Et je vais essayer de les lister en conclusion. Première condition de félicité, la recherche nous montre qu'il faut, notamment dans les collectivités locales, que se mette en place une alliance entre les élus et les fonctionnaires. Il faut un binôme solide. Il faut qu'un acteur politique, et ça c'est un paradoxe, un acteur politique puissant s'engage dans la durée, dans ses démarches, pour que tout le monde finalement y croit. Et il faut aussi que, par exemple, le directeur des services ne fasse pas barrage. Si vous avez ces deux éléments en place, et si vous avez un petit peu de temps, c'est-à-dire qu'il n'y ait pas une alternance qui change l'un ou l'autre, là vous pouvez mettre en place des chantiers intéressants. Le problème, c'est que le temps manque et souvent la volonté politique initiale manque. Très souvent, celui qui s'occupe de la participation dans une collectivité ou une assemblée, c'est celui qui n'a pas de pouvoir. Ou en tout cas, c'est un élu minoritaire sans surface politique. Et là, ça ne peut pas marcher. Pour que ça marche, il faut être très attentif aux formes de la discussion, aux outils qu'on utilise. On ne peut pas s'improviser. Il ne suffit pas de mettre des élus avec des citoyens pour que la participation, elle naisse d'un seul coup. Toute la logistique, l'ingénierie de la participation est une chose absolument essentielle. Et notamment l'usage de technologies numériques aujourd'hui, on en parlera cet après-midi, me semble dans un certain nombre de cas impératif, notamment pour toucher des publics qui ne peuvent plus décemment aujourd'hui perdre du temps dans des discussions de face à face. Troisième élément, il faut protéger les intermédiaires, protéger les tiers garants. Il faut des institutions qui soient suffisamment légitimes et suffisamment autonomes pour garantir la qualité du débat public. En France, nous avons toute une réflexion autour de la notion de garant, de tiers garant. Il faut, à l'image de la Commission nationale du débat public, se soucier de ces gens qui n'ont comme finalité dans leur action que de produire un débat de qualité et inclure le maximum de personnes. Il faut, quatrième élément, penser, comme l'a dit le Président tout à l'heure, il faut penser que ça n'est pas le tout de la démocratie participative, ne suffira pas à résoudre toutes les questions. Et que pour que ça fonctionne, il faut quand même qu'il y ait, à l'extérieur des dispositifs institutionnalisés, de la pression citoyenne. Il faut des mobilisations, il faut qu'il y ait de la contre-démocratie. Si vous ne parvenez pas à la stimuler, si vous ne parvenez pas à mobiliser, il est clair que les dispositifs tombent d'eux-mêmes, hein, ils s'étiolent très facilement. Avant-dernière préconisation, il faut jouer sur la complémentarité des dispositifs. Compte tenu de la diversité des finalités de chaque dispositif, vous ne pouvez pas être quitte avec une seule procédure. Il faut parfois des montages très complexes qui articulent à des moments différents du processus de décision des dispositifs différents. Avant-dernière préconisation, il faut être clair sur les intentions. Ce qui n'est quasiment jamais le cas. Qu'est-ce qui est en discussion et qu'est-ce qui ne l'est pas? Qu'est-ce que l'on peut faire et qu'est-ce que l'on ne peut pas faire? L'ambiguïté domine très souvent et elle est absolument délétère. Et puis le dernier point, c'est ne jamais oublier l'idéal d'inclusion, c'est-à-dire qu'il faut toujours faire en sorte qu'il y ait le moins d'absents significatifs possible, ou en tout cas que ces absents soient représentés, parce que si on ne le fait pas, à ce moment-là, on risque de produire beaucoup plus d'effets pervers que d'avancées démocratiques. Voilà, j'ai été vraiment très long, très magistral, et j'en suis désolé, mais je vous remercie pour votre attention.
Merci beaucoup, professeur Blondiot, pour cet exposé long peut-être, mais en tout cas très passionnant. Et sans plus attendre, je vais céder la parole à David Farrell. David Farrell, the floor is yours. Et normalement, il y a donc une traduction simultanée pour les personnes qui le souhaitent via les petits casques.
I have to apologize that because of my linguistic inabilities, I'm going to be speaking to you in English, but I understand you have translation. And I will do my best to avoid the Irish disease of speaking too quickly. So hopefully I manage to do that. Can people hear me okay? Yes? So I'm very grateful for this invitation to speak to you today. And I look forward to giving you some sense of the Irish Constitutional Convention and what it's all been about. I provided the organisers of today's workshop with a background paper, which I gather will be available to you at some stage for you to read more into this. So I'm going to try and talk to the background paper in the few minutes I have before you. And I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you a story about an extraordinary experiment. And I call it an experiment because the view that we have is this is probably a world's first. It's a world first in at least two respects. First of all, in the sense that we're using deliberation as a means of having a meaningful discussion about constitutional reform in Ireland. And secondly, because that deliberation involves citizens sitting next, side by side, with elected politicians. We're not aware of those two features being done before, at least at a national level, anywhere else. And as I will try to outline to you, I think the view seems to be that this is an experiment that has succeeded. Now, the experiment is still ongoing. The Irish Constitutional Convention has not yet completed its work. So all I can do is give you a preliminary assessment today. And I need to declare an interest from the beginning, which is that I am the research director of the convention. So I'm biased. I think it's been very successful, but I will let others judge eventually whether that is the case or not. So hopefully it does work. Okay. I'm going to talk to you briefly in three parts. I'm going to first of all outline the origins of the Irish Constitutional Convention. Then I'm going to talk a bit about how it works, how it operates, what it does. And then finally, I'll give you my preliminary assessment of its work and its outcomes to date. So let me start with its origins. We were in an unprecedented situation. I arrived back in Ireland myself in 2009, having lived in Britain for 20 years. I left Ireland 20 years earlier because we had an economic crisis in the 1980s and I couldn't find work. I came back in 2009 and we were yet again in an economic crisis and many people can't find work. And I can't emphasize enough just what an economic crisis this was. This started in about 2008, 2009, and only today, only now in 2014, are we beginning to see the early signs of us emerging from this crisis. So the sense of fear was palpable. There was a genuine fear that banks would stop operating, that salaries would stop being paid to public servants, that services would start to close down. If you visited Ireland at that time, you would have felt the strong sense of fear, but also the strong sense of anger at our political class for having put us in this dreadful situation, the worst economic crisis in our history. So a huge sense of public anger. And by coincidence, in 2011, the government was forced to go to an election. It had reached the end of its term of office. So by coincidence, we had an election right in the middle of this economic storm, the perfect conditions for dramatic political change. And sure enough, that's what we had. The government parties were decimated in that election. The Green Party lost all its seats in Parliament. It no longer has any seats. And the Fianna Fáil Party, which I can tell you as a political scientist, is known as being one of the most successful government parties in Europe. It is almost always in government. It was decimated in that election also. It is now the third biggest party in the Parliament. And there's still a debate about whether that party will survive in the long term. So we had a new government that was elected as a result of this electoral earthquake, as it is called. A new government that had a very strong mandate for political and structural reform. In their manifestos, the political parties put a lot of emphasis on the need for political and economic reform, and the government said that they were going to implement this. But at the heart of this desire for political reform particularly, and institutional reform, at the heart of this was a sense that citizens needed to be involved. The citizens of Ireland were angry, so the sense was, well, we better make sure that the citizens have some involvement in debates about how we change our system for the good. And here I have to again declare some interest, because I think it's safe to say that Irish political science has had a role here. It's unfortunate that you're not going to hear about the G1000 experience here in Belgium. I'm sure you've witnessed it yourself in the media. I was very fortunate to be there in 2011, I think it was, for the big G1000 event in Brussels. Well, we were doing the same thing in Ireland. We didn't know about each other before we started. But in Ireland, we had an organization called We the Citizens. And the role of We the Citizens was to try and promote the idea of citizen-led processes of debating reform. Trying to debate the idea, trying to present the idea that deliberation, particularly, is a way in which citizens could be brought into the reform process. So we were doing the same thing in Ireland that G1000 has been trying to do here in Belgium. And I think it's safe to say that we certainly have had some success. As I will outline to you now, that it's pretty clear that some of the issues that political science in Ireland were raising, some of those issues were adopted by the Irish government in the design of the Irish Constitutional Convention. So this is the basic gist of what the convention is all about. It consists of 100 members. It was established at the end of 2012 by the Irish government. It was told that it had 1 year to complete its work, and it would have 100 members. And those 100 members comprise a chair. So that's the 100th member is a chair who sits, like my colleague above me. And then 33 politicians. Those are elected politicians from the National Parliament. Some of them are actually from the Northern Ireland Parliament also, but most of them come from the Parliament in Dublin. So they're from the National Parliament. There's even one of them is a government minister. So these are elected politicians who are giving up their time to be members, 33 of them, of the convention. And then the 66 citizens. This is the crucial ingredient. Those 66 citizens have been randomly selected by an opinion poll company. And the objective was to make sure that there was a decent balance in terms of gender representation, age, education, region, socioeconomic status. I know with 66 people that's hard to get perfect, but I can tell you it's pretty good. There's a pretty good representation of all sectors of Irish society among those 66. So they're the members, randomly selected. That's the important point, and I imagine my colleague was talking about that in his previous talk. These citizens didn't nominate themselves. They didn't run for election. Somebody knocked on their door and said, "Would you like to be a member of the convention?" And then they volunteered. They were given 8 topics, and I list some of the more prominent ones. The 8 topics is a curious mix from the really mundane to some quite important issues. I've put some of the important issues up there. Whether we should change our electoral system. There's a lot of blame attached to the fact that our electoral system is seen to encourage a form of politics that is not ideal for our system. I can go into that in the questions if you want. Same-sex marriage, a big debate about whether we should have same-sex marriage in Ireland. The role of women in politics, whether we should reduce the voting age, and then votes for immigrants, blasphemy, and other technical matters. 8 topics. And very often people ask, why these 8 topics? And there's many answers, but I'll give you the basic one, which is this, that I know in Belgium you take your time to form governments. In Ireland we do things differently. So when a coalition government is about to be formed, there's huge media interest and a lot of speculation and a sense of crisis in the air until the government is formed. The same sort of thing went on in Britain, you will have noticed, when they formed their coalition. So unlike you, where it can take years almost, for us it takes days. A government has to be formed. And so in forming the government, the coalition partners had very intense negotiations, and there were certain things they just couldn't come to agreement on. So they put those 8 things into a bucket, and they said, right, we'll set up this convention, we'll involve the citizens in discussing all sorts of things, and these are the 8 things we'll give it to do. So that's why we have the 8 topics that we have. And if you want to find out more about it, there is a website. That's just a clip from the front page, but the website address is there for you to see. So I recommend you go there. You will see, for example, live streaming of a lot of the sessions. are available to you on the website. So the work of the convention, how does it work? Well, here's just a wee picture, just to give you a flavour of it. It's very different from the shape of this room, and that's a deliberate way that it should operate. We use a hotel ballroom. I know it sounds bizarre, but it works. And you can see in the picture the sort of idea. This was early in the morning, so some of the people hadn't arrived yet. This is why some of the tables are a little bit emptier. But there's the sort of sense of the average table. You've got some citizen members, you've got some politicians, and at every table, you've got that mix, citizen members and politicians. When we go to the next meeting, the membership of the tables is changed, so you're never sitting with the same people from one meeting to the next. There is a trained facilitator at every table, and there is a note taker at every table to make sure that we are documenting what is discussed at the table. And there's me at the back, just so you see, I do have some involvement there, even if you don't really see me. But that's a sort of example of an average day in the life of the Constitutional Convention. It meets for a weekend. And I know this may sound less than ideal, but this is the way it was set up. The budget was very limited. So when it meets for all day of a Saturday and all morning of a Sunday. So it's a Saturday all day and then Sunday morning, roughly once a month. And it has been meeting now for a little over a year. It has two more meetings to go in February, and then it ceases to exist. And how it works is that we involve experts. So experts are brought in. They provide briefing documents in advance about the topic for discussion. The members are sent those briefing documents a week before to read them. And then the experts speak to the members directly, answer any questions, and then they leave the room. And then the work begins. And the work is done at those small tables with trained facilitators. So small group deliberation. The object is that the people around the table must respect the views and opinions of the others. That there must be a sense that your opinions might be prepared, you might be prepared to change your views. You become informed on the basis of what you've heard from the experts and on the basis of the discussion with your fellow colleagues around the table. And that must be an openness, a sense of openness to be prepared to change. And we know members have said that they have changed their views on topics. And what has it done to date? In the paper I provided, so you can see it for yourself, there's a table at the back. But basically, those eight topics that I mentioned to you have resulted so far, and the work is still not finished, as I said, has resulted in 24 recommendations. 24 recommendations for change in politics and political institutions in Ireland. And according to my estimation, 12 of those 24 recommendations would require a referendum to change our constitution, because our constitution can only be changed by referendum. And here's a list of some of the more significant recommendations. So the convention has said that there should be same-sex marriage in Ireland. There should be gay marriage in Ireland. The convention has proposed that there should be a reduction of the voting age in our national general election to 16. As you may know, Austria already does that. So Ireland is now going to have a referendum to consider doing that also. It's proposed the possibility for citizen initiatives. This is something we don't have, but other countries in Europe does. I don't know about Belgium. But the possibility that citizens can petition for a referendum to change the constitution. That's now a proposal of the convention. It's proposed votes for citizens overseas and in Northern Ireland in presidential elections. And then there's more and more and more. There's 24 recommendations. I can only really give you a flavour in the time that I've got. So, my third and final section, an assessment. And as I stressed at the outset, the work of the convention is still ongoing, so this can only be a preliminary assessment at this stage. So, the way I'm going to do the assessment is I want to look at three issues. And these are three issues that came up at the beginning as forms of criticism of the convention. I really should stress that when the convention was established, it faced two reactions. People just ignored it. Most journalists just ignored it completely, gave it no coverage, refused to come to the meetings. They thought it was a total waste of public money and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So that was one form of criticism. But the second, more explicit form of criticism were prominent opinion pieces in some newspapers and on social media, where leading figures, prominent journalists, were saying this is a total waste of taxpayers' money. Some journalists even said, how on earth could you involve citizens in discussions about change of our constitution? What do citizens know? You know, it's the role for politicians and people who know better. There's a very strong sense like that from many of our journalists. And I know that that is not unique in Ireland. That happens elsewhere. But the criticisms came in three main areas. And the first was the composition. And there were a couple of points, but the key point of criticism here was that you're putting citizens sitting together with politicians. 66 citizens coming from anywhere, you know, God knows where they were going to come from, was the view. Sitting with experienced, hard-nosed, you know, tough-skinned politicians. Well, what was going to happen? The criticism was obvious, that you were going to have politicians dominating the discussions. The politicians were going to say to the citizens, I know better than you. I know how this works. Let me tell you how it works. And politicians talking more and more rather than the citizens having an opportunity to speak. So the sense was that this was a big mistake, that unlike the citizens' assemblies of British Columbia, Ontario, or the Netherlands, where it was only citizens on their own, the view was if you put politicians in the room with citizens, you would not get proper deliberation. You would get debating, point scoring, and you would not get citizens having their say. And all I can say is that that has been proven wrong. Anyone who has come to the convention meetings and witnessed how they operate has come away with that view, that that is wrong, that there is plenty of opportunity for citizen members to speak. An additional point, of course, that many of the critics didn't notice because they weren't paying attention, really, was that we were following deliberative practice. As I pointed out to you earlier on, small groups sitting at tables with trained facilitators, and the job of the facilitator is to keep an eye on things to make sure that everyone gets a fair chance to speak. So if a politician or anyone is speaking too much at the table, the facilitator is instructed to say, okay, we've heard your view, I want to hear it from this person. We haven't heard what this person has to say. And we've been monitoring that, and we can say categorically that everyone at the table has had a fair opportunity to speak. We survey the members every single weekend, and they all give 99%, 95% anyway, very positive reaction to their experience. And the other thing about the composition that I think I should point out, and this was not something that many of us had expected, is this. If any of you have ever heard about the Citizens' Assembly in British Columbia, Ontario, or the Netherlands, one of the points that came out of the research on that was that because it was citizens on their own who were in the room and the politicians were excluded from the process, the politicians then took away their bucket and spades and didn't have anything to do with it. So when the Citizens' Assemblies of British Columbia, Ontario in particular, when they produced referendum proposals, the politicians stepped back and didn't campaign in the referendums because their view was, well, we weren't involved in that. It let the citizens who were involved in that be the ones who try and promote the ideas that they proposed. Whereas what we have in Ireland are cheerleaders. And you see this when we've had Parliament debates about some of the recommendations so far of the Constitutional Convention. You can go yourself to the website of the Irish Parliament and you can see it for yourselves if you don't believe me. That the most positive views in the chamber of the Parliament are from the members of the Convention because they are members of the Parliament. And they're saying to their colleagues, I was there, I didn't think it was going to work, but it's worked. And I can tell you, you should come and watch it if you don't believe me. That's the sort of points that have been made by the politicians. So we're getting a very strong sense of connection between this deliberative process and the normal cut and thrust of parliamentary politics. That's been a very positive outcome, and in many ways an unanticipated outcome. The second of the three areas of criticism is over the agenda. You remember I said at the beginning that there were these eight topics dumped into a bucket because the coalition negotiators couldn't agree on them, so they said, let's let the convention do this. And so one of the criticisms of the convention when it started was, well, come on, these eight topics. I mean, I'll tell you what one of the topics was. One of the other topics was the Irish presidency. We elect a president of Ireland who has no powers. He has less powers than the British Queen. But he is elected by the people. And he's elected for a 7-year term. So the view was, in some quarters, well, the French have been debating about whether they should reduce the length of term of the French presidency. I mean, the French presidency is quite a different entity to the Irish presidency. But anyway, why don't we do it also? So one of the 8 topics was, should we reduce the term of the Irish president and have the election at the same time as the European Parliament elections? Who gives a damn? It was just one of those 8 topics dumped into the dustbin that the convention was asked to consider. And they considered it, and they basically said, we don't give a damn, we don't have a view on it. But as I said, there were some very meaty topics like same-sex marriage, the electoral system, voting age, etc. So the agenda was eclectic at best. In any event, the criticism was, it's a limited agenda, the convention should be asked to do much more important things than this. And all I can say is the following by way of defense. First of all, what the convention has managed to do is to be very imaginative in stretching its role beyond the narrow confines of those 8 topics. As I said to you already, it has already made 24 recommendations for change based on those 8 topics, and its work is not concluded yet. So it's been very imaginative in that sense. But the second is summarized in that phrase, any other amendments, because there was a little dot, dot, dot at the end of the parliamentary instrument that was passed to set up the convention, which was that the government proposed to the convention, when you have completed your work, when you have discussed those 8 topics, you can then consider any other amendments. So what the convention did was it went on a roadshow around the country. This might take a while because it's got pictures, and I think Jean-Benoit's computer is quite slow. It went around the country on a roadshow. This is just 3 of, I think there were 7, maybe more meetings around Ireland. And as you can see, they're pretty well attended. So the convention went to different parts of the country and basically announced in every way it could to the people in the area, we're coming to your town. We want to listen to what you want us to discuss under any other amendments. What do you want us to discuss? And also there was space put aside on the website prominently for anyone to make submissions on any other amendments. And in total, there were over 700 proposals. 700 proposals for any other issues to be discussed. So that was quite a big ask to consider 700 things. The convention has only got 2 more weekends to go. And it is those 2 weekends, 2 more meetings, that will discuss the any other amendments. So what the convention members did was they reduced the 700 to 5 main areas and then voted on which areas they would want to discuss. And they have voted that they will discuss on February the 1st and 2nd at our next meeting, parliamentary reform. So whether and how to reform our parliament. There's a big debate about the weakness of the Irish parliament. And then the very final meeting at the end of February will be on the question of economic, social and cultural rights, whether we should write into our constitution the protection of economic, social and cultural rights. So the agenda is not as limited as many of the critics said, both because the convention has been very imaginative in how it stretched its remit, but also by the use of any other amendments. And my final, the final assessment point, the final area of criticism is its limited advisory role. And I know my colleague was talking a bit about this in his presentation earlier on, this issue about what happens after. So the convention makes a recommendation, what happens next? And the criticism that was made at this point was, when the convention was established, was this, that all it can do is advise. So it makes a recommendation, the recommendation goes back to the government, and the government then has to give a response to that recommendation. So the view was, well, it's only got an advisory role, so, you know, we all know what happens. Politicians are terrible, aren't they? They'll receive the report from experts, and they just put them into a dusty shelf and forget about it, and that's the end of it. So this is a total waste of time. That was the tenor of the criticism. But what many of the critics failed to notice was that written into the detail of the proposal for setting up this convention, it was made very clear that the government has a commitment to respond to the Parliament within 4 months of receipt of a recommendation. So At the end of a weekend, there's a report written based on the recommendation of the convention. The report is lodged in the Irish Parliament, and the government has to respond to the Parliament within 4 months. That means it can't ignore it. It has to give a response. It can't just let it gather on a dusty shelf.